A deadly case of immigrant smuggling in Texas shocks the nation. This hour, the Iowa connection to that tragedy. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The AP's Ryan Foley tells us about the small family-owned Iowa trucking company linked to those deaths in Texas. Also today, big changes to the state's volunteer water quality monitoring program. We'll get a couple of perspectives. IPR's Joyce Russell on a number of stories she's been covering this week. An Iowa transgender Marine Corps veteran reacts to the president's ban on transgender service. And Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register with highlights from RAGBRAI 2017. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're on board for this handful of quick conversations to end our news week. Well, water quality in Iowa's lakes and streams is, generally speaking, pretty poor, as in not good. But it is a good thing that water quality has received more attention as a priority. Or is it really being treated as a priority? As Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden reported this week, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has made big changes to the state's volunteer water quality monitoring program. This comes after statewide budget cuts, totaling some $1.2 million of funding reduction to the DNR. Now, here's the change to the state's volunteer water quality monitoring program. After providing initial training and resources, the continued administration and funding of the program is then turned over to local government agencies and nonprofits that choose to take up the mantle of volunteer water monitoring. Now, previously, the DNR was the program's sole administrator. Here to explain that to us is Alan Bonini. He's supervisor of the Iowa DNR's Watershed Improvement Program. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Ben. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon to you. So, remind us, some may not be very acquainted with this volunteer water quality monitoring program. What is it there for?
Well, it's there primarily to get citizens engaged and aware of conditions of their waters. The primary purpose of the program is to get people engaged, get them aware, and hopefully at the local level lead them to a point where they want to do something to make changes and hopefully make improvements in water quality in their area for the water resources that they find value in. And that's what we've learned over the years in my program, in the Watershed Improvement Program. We work closely with local leadership and local watershed groups who have who appreciate the value of their water resource and they want to make it better.
So in a word, sort of taking ownership of the water quality that's dearest to you in your area. Tell us, what is the change that happened July 1st in how this program runs?
Sure. The change is really we've recognized we're a data-driven agency. I mean, we're a lot of scientists, and so we rely heavily on data to guide our decision making. And you know, over the years, we've seen several notable challenges with the program. We've seen the number of participants in the program as volunteers decline. The number of data points, if you will, the data that's being given to us as a result of the water quality monitoring that the volunteers do has been declining, and the number of people who are signing up to be trained has declined. In fact, this last year, we didn't have enough people to even schedule a single training program, and the year before that, we only had 86 people that signed up to be volunteers. At the peak of the program, back in the mid-2000s, 2003 to 2005, we averaged training over 255 people a year. And so we've seen a decline in the interest in the program, the activity by the communities. And at the same time, the budget that the monitoring program overall the department has remained static since 2001. And so, as you can imagine, our costs are going up, But when your budget stays the same, it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain services at the level that they have been historically. And so, you know, we saw this program kind of on life support, and we needed to find a way to revitalize it. And my program has worked closely with local watershed groups for a better part of a dozen years. Mm-hmm. And in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been an increasing interest in creating and growing these watershed management authorities across the state. 7 years ago, we didn't have any, and now we're up to 21, almost 22. And we see that as a much more effective way to deliver the volunteer monitoring program is through these locally led programs, because then you've got a local leadership group who can organize and coordinate the volunteers, and as volunteers either can't do it anymore or lose interest, they're in a much better position to find alternative volunteers to step in and take over that work.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't have the capacity to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Alan, just to play devil's advocate here, I mean, you're painting a rosy picture that this is a good move, but this is less burden for the DNR, less budget that has to be dedicated to this from the DNR. You could see this as just passing the buck down to the local governments and volunteer groups and saying, here, we haven't been able to do this, you do this.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, somebody could look at it that way, but we look at it as, you know, we're trying to find a way to keep the program going. I mean, we are, you know, we're strong advocates for monitoring, but we can only operate within the budgetary universe that we have to work with. And so we constantly are trying to find creative ways to keep our programs going and keep them active and vital. And, you know, we've got 8 new watershed management authorities that were recently created that are being supported by a significant grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Iowa Watershed Approach Project. And collectively, they have several millions of dollars that are being put into those projects to help them develop watershed plans and begin to implement them. And we think they might be a good starting point for this project, because they're going to have the resources and the personnel to be able to organize these kinds of volunteer programs at the local level and hopefully keep them sustained.
So the training will still come from the DNR. Will any monies for like these testing kits? You have to have testing kits to test water, right?
Yep, and that's another thing we think will improve, because what we're going to do is we're going to be set up a train the trainers program where we will train a group of local leaders who have organized themselves to want to run one of these programs, and they will have all the training they need to then in turn train their volunteers. As those volunteers cycle through their system, they'll have that expertise they can continue to pass on to those volunteers. And we will give each new group a starter set of kits to get them started. We're also going to provide them access to our vendor that we use with the state, so they can hopefully take advantage of the discounted pricing that we have available to us. And one of the other things that we've learned over the years is that, well, first of all, these kits, the materials in these kits have expiration dates on them. After a certain date, you're no longer supposed to use them because they lose their accuracy. And we were seeing a lot of shrinkage. In other words, a lot of these kits were not being fully utilized before they expired. And we actually sort of beta tested this and had some conversations with the Polk County's County Conservation Board, because they have a program just like this. And what they do is they take their kits and they break them apart, if you will, and they make sure that all the volunteers have just enough materials to be able to use in the time that they can be used, so that they really have an effective way to reduce the amount of waste in the program. And that's an important thing, too. We all want to try to reduce waste.
Right, right. And you said you're data-driven scientists. I think those were your words here. Are you confident that under this new scheme, with the DNR sort of stepping away from it or removing itself in sort of a way, that the data will be valuable, useful to collect and collate? Is the DNR going to take this data from around the state and put it in a useful form?
And that's an interesting question, because we are bound by the credible data law. The volunteer monitoring data that's collected, we can't use in our scientific work. The data that's collected by these volunteers is really meant to inform and educate them and their local communities on where their hotspots might be, where they might want to focus their efforts to try to make improvements in water quality.
So it's useless. It's useless at a state level for policymaking.
It's It certainly can help inform generally, but we can't use it in our scientific analysis. But there's also, and this is something else, we used to maintain a database that was online that people could put their data into and everyone could see it. Unfortunately, with technological changes and security changes, we have not been able to upgrade and maintain that database. But EPA, the U.S. EPA, fortunately, has a nationwide database that's available to anyone to put their data up for the public to see. And so what we've directed and what we will be directing groups to do is if they want to share that data broadly beyond their own community's needs and interests, they can put that data up on the EPA database, and EPA maintains that database. They obviously have much more significant resources than we do, and they also have training modules so people can learn how to use the database. And so we think that's going to be a much more sustainable alternative for putting that information out there for anybody within the public sphere to be able to look at and use.
Okay, Alan, very, very quickly before we go, tell us how people get involved, because you're seeing a lack of enthusiasm, a lack of volunteerism. We know people are concerned about water quality in the state, and especially water quality in the local area where our listeners are living.
First step would be to go to our DNR website and just in the search box just type in volunteer monitoring, and that'll take you to our webpage that has all the information about who to contact, where to go. And if as we're telling people who are emailing us, we're saying, you know, if you're currently a volunteer, we'll help you hook up with a local watershed group in your area. If you've been a past volunteer and you want to start again, the same thing. And if you find out there isn't a group in your area, we encourage you to take that leadership role and go to those groups, to the leaders of those watershed groups, and encourage them to begin a program and maybe volunteer to lead that program for them. If we're all hands on deck on this, I think we can make this a much better and much more sustainable program.
Okay. Alan Bonini, supervisor of the Iowa DNR's Watershed Improvement Program. Alan, thanks for the explanation.
Thank you, Ben. Have a great afternoon.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you just joined us talking about a new way of running the volunteer water quality monitoring program in the state. This is after the DNR had more than sort of a $1.2 million funding reduction. They turned to this as a different approach, also to reduce their budget in this case. They're going to provide initial training and resources, but the continued administration and funding of this volunteer water quality monitoring program now turned over to local government agencies and nonprofits who choose to take up this mantle of volunteer water monitoring. For another perspective, let's turn to Rich Leopold. Rich is director of Polk County Conservation. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Ben.
You heard Alan Bonini there explain the new approach. What do you think?
Well, I know Al. We've worked together in the past, and his explanation was largely correct, although a lot of it is nuanced, and I guess I'm here to offer the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say.
Okay, what is it?
Well, I think he touched on it early on, that I believe this is largely because of budget cuts. This program, you know, when we're talking about diminished volunteer activity, that's largely because you reap what you sow. And that for years now, for about 6 years, there's been less and less effort paid to volunteer programs, AmeriCorps programs, monitoring programs across the board at the DNR. And that largely this is a result of budget cuts.
Okay, so that reduction and that pointed question I didn't get to ask him is, why are the volunteers dropping off after an initial period of enthusiasm, dropping down to what, 80-some, and not even enough to warrant a team training there? You're saying, point it back to the DNR and the funding of the DNR, saying you have to generate interest? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it has to be, you know, distributed, marketed, education has to happen. Staffing within the water monitoring program has been going down consistently for years now. And that's not Mr. Bonini's fault. That's just a result of legislative and gubernatorial action, that they've been getting less and less money. We have a very robust program at Polk County Conservation, not just volunteer water monitoring, but we have thousands of people. And we're not seeing any reduction at all in volunteer activities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what do you think of this new approach when we look at it statewide of turning it over to local government agencies and nonprofits? And Polk County, you seem to have a strong conservation backers, volunteers there. What is the key? Is there some truth there, or is there a a way forward where we say, you know, actually local authorities can do a better job of generating enthusiasm and keeping volunteers on for the long haul?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag there. I mean, when we started this program, I was the Iowa Water's first coordinator back in 2000. That when we put this together, it was state government, so it was the DNR and the Department of Ag and Land Stewardship. It was nonprofits, the Iowa Environmental Council and the Isaac Walton League were big. It was academia. We had University of Iowa Hygienic Laboratory and also the federal government. So there was a lot of disjointed programs at that point in time that we unified within Iowa Water so that we could better train, support the data, do what we needed to do as far as supplies and stuff like that. And Al was right. We had a program that was training, you know, hundreds and thousands of people across the state. Al described it as being an engagement and awareness network, and it certainly is that. That was one of the primary purposes. But the data is also useful. The DNR can only monitor so much water and has only so much eyes on the water, if you will. This provided a very large red flag network. So if there were bad things that happened, volunteers in the field would find them and identify them and bring them to authorities. It also established long-term trends. So especially in some of these smaller water bodies, the smaller streams across the state, there is virtually no monitoring whatsoever. And having a couple thousand volunteers across the state inputting data into a common statewide database would provide for scientific trend analysis, which we're going to be losing if it's only small and spotty local watershed groups.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be small and spotty, or will this go forward and people take up the cause?
I think it's going to be small and spotty at best. I mean, here at Polk County Conservation, we have a robust program largely using our staff and a few super volunteers, if you will. But unless you have a solid statewide framework which to hang your hat, it's very difficult to maintain a local effort in a lot of the rural areas of our state.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of all the talk from elected leaders, also including former Governor Branstad, about water quality being a top priority?
Yeah, well, this... when actions and words contradict, you follow your actions and not the words, right?
Remind us, I started off by talking about how Iowa's water quality in the lakes and streams in our state is pretty poor. How bad is it for someone who doesn't have much to do with lakes and streams, I guess, sure. Is someone listening? How bad is the water quality out there, and is it getting any better?
Well, it is getting better in places, and when you talk water quality, it's a very complicated subject. So if you're talking water quality on a beach, then you're concerned about bacteria and safely swimming. If you're talking water quality in a stream, perhaps you're talking about paddling or maybe fishing or something like that. You know, is water quality where it doesn't have algae blooms and low dissolved oxygen? Is water quality where I can stand in waist-high water and see my toes wiggle? So there's a lot of different definitions of water quality. There are successes in our state, and Al actually in his career has been presiding by a lot of those successes. Our lakes restoration program is doing a great job across the state. Some of our localized efforts working with farmers and communities have done really good jobs. Overall, we have some significant problems in this state with sedimentation, with nitrate, with aquatic life, and we need to devote a lot more resources and attention than we have been historically. That doesn't mean everything is bad everywhere. It's still safe most of the time in most places. Get in the water and play.
All right. Nice words to leave us with. Rich Leopold, Director of Polk County Conservation. Thanks for your time, Rich. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, you surely heard the president tweeting that he will ban transgender people from serving in the military in any capacity. Well, yesterday, producer Emily Woodbury spoke with Des Moines resident Jack Schuler, a transgender service member, to get his perspective on this week's news.
I'm a sergeant in the Army Reserve. I'm a chemical operations specialist. I served for 5 years in the Marine Corps as a linguist. I was honorably discharged, and I am a transgender service member. When I heard the announcement the other day, I was floored. And in a moment, it felt like everything I worked for was falling apart. And you know, I immediately snap into action trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do about this? And I started making phone calls. I called Senator Duckworth of Illinois because I figured she would be sympathetic to my, you know, to my cause. And I realized, like, I wanted to use this opportunity to let people get to know someone who would be affected by this policy and let, you know, and let them see that I'm just a regular service member. I'm no different than anybody else who serves. And, you know, I want to have my career. I don't want it to end like this.
Mm-hmm. And have you gotten any word from superiors, you know, any direction from above as to, you know, how things are going to be handled or next steps or just things you should know about?
Not yet. I'm sure at some point over these next couple days, I'm going to have a talk with my chain of command and see what they think. And, you know, it's good that so many legislators like Senators Grassley and Ernst and, you know, Joint Chiefs themselves have all reiterated that they don't want to reinstate the ban. So that's lifted my spirits a lot.
Now, you were serving before former President Obama reversed the ban, correct?
Yes.
What was it like to serve then compared to now?
When I first enlisted, I knew I was a member of the LGBT community, but I didn't understand my gender identity, and I enlisted as female. And over time, I've come to realize who I truly am, and I wanted to come out before the ban was lifted, but I was afraid of losing my career then. And fortunately, President Obama lifted the ban, and I was finally able to be who I am and serve at the same time.
And did you feel well received by, you know, your peers? You know, did you feel, I mean, you said you felt kind of scared to come out, you know, before, but afterwards, how did it go?
Well, you know, the unit I serve with is based out of a red state. So I was kind of worried that they, you know, a lot of the people in the unit wouldn't be very receptive. And, you know, there are a lot of old timers, you know, guys who have been in for forever and a day. And I wasn't sure if they'd be receptive, but when I started talking to the folks I serve with, to my command, they were supportive, and they're like, all right.
What would you like people to know about this issue?
I'd like them to know that we're real human beings. We're not just a bunch of numbers. You know, people talk about how many transgender service members they believe to be serving right now. But put faces to those numbers. You know, put my face on one of those numbers. Put somebody else's face on one of those numbers. We're people. We want to serve. We volunteered. And a lot of us got in during the ban. We didn't sign up for freebies. We signed up to serve. Just let us serve. Let us do what we volunteered to do.
That was Des Moines resident Jack Schuler, a sergeant in the Army Reserves and a transgender Des Moines resident. Coming up in just a moment, Joyce Russell on a few stories she's been covering this week. Also, the AP's Ryan Foley with the Iowa connection to that deadly case of immigrant smuggling in Texas. And Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register with highlights from RagBrite 2017. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back after a short break. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some of the news this week. As we end this week, let's start off by checking in with Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio legislative correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
Wanted to have a few words with you to follow up on some of the things you've been reporting about this week. You talked about the implementation of Iowa's new collective bargaining law. Critics say it will make it harder for unions to continue to represent public employees. So what is different for public sector workers?
Well, the part that was under discussion this week was the part of the bill that has to do with recertification votes for local unions. Currently, once a union is certified to represent a group of local workers, whether it's teachers or snowplow drivers or whatever it is, then that stays in place. That bargaining unit stays in place until workers are unhappy with it and choose to decertify. Under the new law, local bargaining units are going to be required to routinely have a recertification vote so that ahead of every time a contract expires, some of these are one-year contracts, some are two, some are five, mm-hmm. but ahead of the expiration of a contract, they have to have a recertification vote. In other words, they have to get a majority of the workers again approving this, and not just a majority of those voting, but a majority, 50% plus one, of all of the people represented in that union. And it's quite a high bar. Mm-hmm. And so the news this week is that the Iowa Public Employee Relations Board is in the process of arranging for those elections. It's going to be a huge administrative task for them. The PERB board at the moment, you know, they are in charge of certification votes or recertification votes, but they're few and far between. Now they're going to have, there's going to be, I believe it's 600 local bargaining units up for a vote this fall.
Wow.
40,000 workers, so they've hired a vendor to conduct these elections. It's quite a big deal. And unions, of course, following this very closely because, you know, there's a chance that some of these bargaining units might not just be able to do the organizational work to make sure everybody in that bargaining unit casts a vote.
Mm-hmm. And there's a court challenge to this at the same time.
Right. The entire collective bargaining bill on a number of counts is being challenged in court by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees and also the Teachers Union. So these things are sort of happening at the same time. Of course, the unions are hoping that this law will get thrown out, but in the meantime, they're proceeding apace to implement it.
Mm-hmm. Joyce Russell, you also reported this week on IPERS, those who depend on the retirement for IPERS know what that is. It's the Iowa Public Employee Retirement Fund. What was discovered this week or talked about? A shortfall?
Well, there's been what they call unfunded liabilities in the fund, in the pension fund. The managers of IPERS take pains to point out that the fund is sound. It's not like they're expecting it to go bankrupt. However, there is not enough money there to pay out everything that's being promised to workers. So there's been some discussion about really radically changing IPERS from it's currently a defined benefit system, changing it to a defined contribution system like a 401k for the private sector. And many public workers are very skeptical about that. And after the passage of the collective bargaining law, which just blindsided the whole labor community, I don't think that's overstating it, they're very, very leery of Republicans coming in and making a big change like that in IPERS, which is, of course, is their retirement fund.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we move on, how did that happen? How do you get so unfunded liabilities in the many billions of dollars?
Well, that's a good question, and one of the presentations that we saw this week was from IPERS, kind of giving a history of that. And for a certain period of time, it's kind of simple math. For a certain period of time, the contributions were not, high enough, not strong enough to pay for all of the promised benefits. And it's not like this is being ignored. Back in 2010, they made some significant changes in the contribution rates that before it was a statutory static that said, this is how much workers will pay. Well, they changed that so that it fluctuates to be more responsive to what's going out of the fund. Changes in early retirement. They made things like that back in 2010, but as the IPERS folks were pointing out, this is a big ship, and it takes a long time to turn those things around.
Oh, that's a good image. That's a good way to put it. Joyce, and finally today, Iowa, probably not a household word in China. But I see you reported that there is was a good reception for members of the All-Iowa Ag Trade Mission now in China.
Well, that's right. And you just said Iowa is not a household word in China. The folks on this trade mission painted a picture as though Iowa is kind of a household
really?
Word in China.
Okay.
Or at the very least, they made a convincing case that Governor Branstad's ambassadorship has raised the profile of Iowa. And they're on this trade mission. There have been many Iowa trade missions to China in the past. But a couple of people on the mission made the point that there seemed to be greater access now, and they're crediting the Branstad ambassadorship. They met with very high-level officials, and they're always, of course, they're always enthusiastic when they go to Asia on these trade missions, but they were especially enthusiastic and were giving Governor Branstad quite a bit of credit for raising the profile mm-hmm. of Iowa among government officials there.
Okay, raising the profile, turning Iowa into household word in China, all good and well and good, but does this impact actually commodities that Iowa produces in terms of trade to China? Will that go up?
Well, that's the hope, of course. That's the point of the trade mission. There are already significant customers for Iowa pork and soybeans, but there are restrictions on a number of other Iowa commodities. One big example is poultry. After the avian flu epidemic, China pretty much cut off poultry imports. And so, of course, that's one of the causes that this Iowa trade mission brought up. Some restrictions on beef, even though it's been opened up, eggs, dairy, and every one of those commodity groups, eggs, dairy, poultry, pork, beef, all of them were on this All-Iowa trade mission. Mm-hmm. And each one of those commodity groups had a chance to talk about their commodity to these high-level officials.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it. Thank you for your reporting and this conversation. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio legislative correspondent. Have a wonderful weekend, Joyce.
You too, Ben. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A deadly case of immigrant smuggling in San Antonio, Texas, shocking the nation this week. You surely heard about that. A truck driver, 60-year-old James Bradley Jr., accused of smuggling at least 100 illegal immigrants inside a sweltering tractor trailer. 10 of the illegal immigrants died. We now turn to the AP's Ryan Foley for the Iowa connection to this tragedy. Ryan is correspondent for the Associated Press based in Iowa City. Hi, Ryan.
Hey.
So tell us, what did you find out about the Iowa connection of the trucking company in this case?
So the company that owned the trailer is Pyle Transportation, which is a longtime family-owned firm based in Shaler, Iowa, which is in Sac County in northwest Iowa. And they've been a trucking firm for decades. They're saying that this driver, James Bradley, had worked with the company for years, and that he was hired as a contractor to transport this trailer from Iowa to Brownsville, Texas, so that because it was being sold to a buyer in Mexico. The company here in Iowa, Pyle, is denying all knowledge of what happened in Texas.
Mm-hmm. You looked into the history, the background of Pyle Transportation, Inc. It has a blemished history.
It does. It does have, in particular, over the last 15 or 20 years, a history of safety violations, of legal violations, of refusing to pay wages to workers who quit or were fired. Of the IRS, just in 2015, said the company had failed to pay taxes for a number of years, over $150,000. And many former drivers that I spoke with did complain that they were pushed to drive too many hours without rest, to falsify the logs that they're required to keep to sort of cover up how many hours they were driving. And in some cases, they were, you know, directed to haul overweight loads across the country on very, very tight deadlines.
Mm-hmm. Back to the tragedy discovered last weekend. Really a ghastly scenario. Dozens of immigrants packed inside this truck. found parked in the searing heat outside this San Antonio Walmart. 10 of those passengers, as I mentioned, died. More than a dozen other hospitalized. Extreme dehydration. One passenger telling investigators they were taking turns breathing from a hole inside the trailer. How then do the driver and the trucking company based in Iowa explain their involvement? I mean, they say they didn't know anything about it. I wonder, you've had the same thought, I'm sure, Ryan. Can you drive an 18-wheeler, park it in a parking lot, and not know there are 100 people in your trailer, the trailer that you're pulling?
Yeah, former drivers I've spoken with say this whole scenario, none of it makes any sense. The explanations that have been given, all the drivers I talked to except for one said, you know, you would know if you had immigrants in the trailer, and that the story that that he didn't know and that he hadn't been given a specific place to drop off the trailer, just none of it makes any sense, and people are and federal investigators are struggling to, you know, put together what happened.
Mm-hmm. Where does it go from here? What the investigation will continue? What could this truck driver James Bradley and I guess the trucking company face, as far as you know?
Well, you know, I think they're trying to unravel a much larger operation. This clearly seems like it was a pretty sophisticated operation. They're saying that it might be linked to one of the cartels in Mexico, and they want to find out how this all worked and what was James Bradley's involvement in it. Did the company know anything about what was going on? Had this ever happened before? And separately, the sort of federal safety regulators, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, they confirmed this week that they are conducting a new investigation of pile transportation, taking a look at their past record.
Mm-hmm. I read, I don't know if it was in your reporting, but in reading about this, the driver could face the death penalty.
That is, if they pursued that, yes, he could face life in prison, or if they pursued it, that he could face the death penalty. That seems somewhat unlikely, you know, unless he was the mastermind of this. And people who know James Bradley are saying that he could have never done anything like this sort of on his own. So, yeah, we'll see. I think there's a lot more to this story that has yet to come out.
Okay, we'll follow your reporting and as this story of the deadly case of immigrant smuggling in San Antonio, Texas, is unraveled, as you said there. Ryan Foley, correspondent with the Associated Press based in Iowa City, about the Iowa connection to that horrible tragedy in Texas. Ryan, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, riders on the Register's annual Great Ride Bike Ride Across Iowa are in their second to last day. Let's see, where have they been? It's the 45th year of RAGBRAI. Started out in Orange City on to Spencer, Algona, Clear Lake, Charles City. Cresco last night, I believe, on to Waukon today, finishing up tomorrow in Lansing. And joining us now, Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist at the Des Moines Register, who's been along pedaling furiously in some cases, otherwise probably just lollygagging. Kyle Munson is, I think you're in a church somewhere. Where are you, Kyle?
Yes, hey, Ben. Good to talk to you. I am in the basement of Zion Lutheran Church in Castalia, Iowa, where we just had another epic pie battle.
Ooh.
Between the Des Moines Register and Just Go Bike team and some folks you might know from NPR.
Okay, who's there from NPR?
Well, I do have my opposing co-captain here from NPR, Mr. Scott Horsley.
All right.
And so we just wrapped, we wrapped a great contest, and maybe I'll let him tell you some of the details.
Okay.
You want to talk to him for a second?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hand the phone over to Scott Horsley at the church there.
Ben, Scott, I wish I had better news for the public radio audience. But we were once again outpied by the Register team.
What happened?
So I blame myself. You know, my teammates. I was in fifth position, and we had a lead coming into fifth position, and I was up against Mike Moraine,
Yeah.
I don't know. I looked over, and he just inhaled his slice.
Scott, explain the competition a little bit.
It's a relay race. There's seven on each side, and each of us has to eat one piece of pie, and each teammate has to finish his piece before the next teammate can begin, just like a swimming relay or a running relay. Except in this case, you have to have a Lutheran referee to make sure that you've in fact cleaned your mouth. That you're not just chipmunking the pie. You got to be.
Yep.
It's got to be clean. Clean your mouth.
Right. Okay. So
you don't. That doesn't come up in a running relay, of course.
No.
Swimming relay.
Scott. So what happened? We radio people are all about using our mouths deftly. We have all the muscles developed. You would think for a pie eating contest. How did you fail us in this oral medium of the press? Those are just people who type words out. We're people who tell stories.
We're gonna have to look at the videotape and do some soul searching, I think, because after back to back losses like this, we're gonna have to rethink. I mean, we recruited a strong team. We brought in some ringers this year. A couple people didn't even know how to ride a bicycle when we started. They were just recruited because they were good pie eaters.
Yeah.
And as I say, I blame myself. I think I was the weak link in the team. So we'll watch the tape and we'll try to learn and grow from this.
Okay, Scott Horsley of NPR taking one for the team. Can you hand me back to Kyle?
Absolutely. I'll hand you back to the leader of the victorious pie eating team, Kyle Munson. Hang on just 1 second.
All right.
Hey, Ben. I have to say I really appreciate the Scott being so magnanimous in his defeat. They are just a great team to battle, and so I would love to give them another chance.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first. The results of the pie eating contest there, Kyle. Let me ask you about a couple of your impressions. You've written about the week as you always do, following along here. I understand, of course, no surprise here. Politics consuming all of our minds. Because of what's going on in Washington, but some political protests along the route this year you wrote about?
Yeah, when we started the week, of course, we started in Northwest Iowa, which is the district of Congressman Steve King, and there were a coalition of different progressive groups in that corner of the state that stood along and protested him, and they had some other, there were even people out there that were talking about the pipeline issue and everything else, but yeah, there was even months ago when it was the Rag Brian Out route was announced, there was talk about King has become so incendiary to some people, even people in his own party, that it had reached this point of detracting tourism. So, yeah, I wrote about that and got some interesting response. Just to this whole notion of, I guess, an entrenched congressman, perhaps, as some people say, becoming more and more extreme in his statements. And he talks about defending Western civilization and what his notion of Western civilization means. And here we have RAGBRAI, which is welcoming people from around the globe to Iowa, to rural communities that find it hard to have a tourism industry sometimes. So there was just a contrast there, and I wrote about that to start the week, which isn't the way I always start the week.
Right. Interesting characters you love to find along RAGBRAI. Any characters to share with us this time quickly before we say goodbye?
Sure. There was one guy I spent some time with, fascinating, Norm Engstrom, who lives in Illinois. He's a biologist over there. And for years, I had never encountered him before, but for years he has been counting all the barns along every RAGBRAI route, and not just counting them for a total, but he has these clicker counters on his bike, and he rates them from excellent down to poor condition or even gone. And so I spent time on the road with him, and it was a fascinating way to see the landscape and not just all the bicyclists.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful weather to end this week. I was envying you. I've been on RAGBRAI the last 4 years. I'm giving this year a miss, but did you get a drenching midweek?
I lucked out. So that was a beautiful day. I got into, that was coming out of Clear Lake, and I got into Rockwell before the downpour, and so I had to work in Rockwell for a while, and by the time I left, it was over. I just had a nice little mist and an overcast sky, and that is ideal for biking.
Right, but the other riders, I assume, were not so lucky.
No, not everybody was so lucky. They were cowering under trees or whatever it might be. So, yeah, that was kind of a topic on the road that day. I just managed to kind of play it well, and I was thankful for it.
Okay, so how many miles left to Waukon?
Well, it's deceptive. So it's a short day tomorrow. I mean, it's I forget, somewhere in the 40-50 range. Today I just have 20 more to get to Waukon, and tomorrow it's a deceptively short day, but it's
hilly.
Very hilly.
Yep.
And so then we from Waukon tomorrow we go to Harpers Ferry, and then ultimately Lansing.
Okay. Well, Kyle, I hope to plan to ride along in 2018. We have seen each other out there before. I wonder if we can make a date here to enjoy a piece of what, rhubarb pie next summer, and you can show me how you... Well, I wouldn't, you know, if it's a really good piece of pie, you don't want to eat it quickly, do you?
No, I have to actually enjoy one now. So, and if, yeah, you know, if you're riding next year, Scott might want to recruit you for the team. So,
okay.
Think about that.
Okay. I will. I have a long time to think about it. Kyle Munson at the Zion Lutheran Church. Where are you now again, Kyle?
In Castalia, Iowa.
All right. Thank you for joining us live from the Zion Lutheran Church in Castalia, Iowa. Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist at the Des Moines Register. Thanks, Kyle, and good writing to you and the others.
Thank you.
Okay. Tomorrow, rather Monday on the program, hey, we have a weekend, and it's a beautiful weekend weather-wise, I think. On Monday, I'll be talking with Jacques Berlinerblau. His new book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. That's Monday on the program. Chance for you to share your college experiences. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.